Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. July 28, 1914, 100 years ago today, this morning, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia and started the First World War. That war that would not end all wars. Now a century has passed and global order seems unpinned again. Ukraine, Iraq, Israel, Gaza, Syria, Afghanistan, Central America, China's land claims, Iran's nuclear ambitions. This hour on Point, looking back at the Great War, World War I, and looking around at our risks now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How volatile does the world feel to you right now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Three historians with us today from Toronto, the celebrated Oxford historian Margaret Macmillan joins us. Her latest book is The War That Ended Peace. Margaret Macmillan, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, thanks for inviting me.
From Gemlik, Turkey, Sean McMeekin is here, history professor at Koç University in Istanbul, author of July 1914, Countdown to War, and The Russian Origins of the First World War. Sean McMeekin, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst and historian Jack Beattie joins us, author of The Lost History of 1914, Reconsidering the Year the Great War Began. Jack, thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom, Margaret, and Sean.
A war of such scale and such transformational quality that it's hard to grasp. George Kennan called it the great seminal catastrophe of the 20th century. Barbara Tuchman, of course, famously wrote about it. She said, "The war lies like a band of scorched earth across human history, dividing what came after from what came before." Margaret Macmillan, could you, before we get into what happened and why, just the impact of this war? It's a century now. There's so much about it that's no longer immediately palpable to us at all. And yet we're told again and again, the world that emerged from World War I was utterly, profoundly different from the world that ended with World War I. What changed, Margaret?
Well, a lot of things changed. I think among them, Europe lost its position of dominance in the world. If you look at what Europe was like before the First World War, it was the center of the world in many ways. It was a financial center. It was the industrial center. It was the scientific and technological center. European countries controlled much of the world, either directly through their empires or indirectly. And the First World War destroyed a lot of that. It undercut European economic dominance. It helped to foster the rise of new powers, of course, particularly the United States. It hastened the demise of the empires. It left a very different map in Europe. It began to foster some of the ideas which came to play such a horrible part in the 20th century, the extremities of the right and left, Bolshevism on the one side and fascism on the other. And so I think we do look back at the First World War and we say that the world before 1914 was a very different world.
Jack, did people at that time feel that they were on the brink of a world war, something perhaps we'd never seen before?
Well, there's debate about that. Some people thought war was inevitable. You see a lot of that in the scholarship. But lately, others have said, no, people thought the war was improbable. And one of the reasons, people could point to things like a softening in relations between Germany and Britain. As late as mid-July in the House of Commons, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Lloyd George, said that with vis-a-vis Germany, the sky with Britain is practically unclouded. In other words, it looked like that was going to go on. Things were actually getting better. So there was this sense that, and then there was just simply the residual belief that things were getting better. The habits of thought inculcated by the long peace, really, from the Napoleonic Wars. Of course, it hadn't been an uninterrupted peace, but there was a view, I think, that peace was the norm. And some people think that the escalatory actions taken by the powers that brought on the war were partly to do with their believing war was impossible. I mean, couldn't have war, so therefore we can push things to the brink.
Sean McMeekin, there is abroad today maybe a sense of things coming
undone. Tensions building up all over the place, unresolved conflicts almost everywhere we look that tempt us to look back on World War I and wonder or fear if we're building up some kind of analogous set of tensions that could... World War seems maybe extreme, but then as Jack says, it seemed unlikely then too. Do you see an analogous or somehow parallel set of tensions building today that ought to have us turn and take lessons from World War I?
Well, I don't think history rhymes in quite that way. Mm-hmm. I think even if you look at 1914, of course, there were tensions between the great powers. There's another line of thought that almost takes it so far in the other direction. There's an author called David Frumkin who spoke of clear air turbulence. That is, it was as if an airplane was just suddenly buffeted about by this unexpected turbulence when people didn't even have the seatbelt lights on. Well, that was true. If you were looking at the world maybe from the prism of Paris or London, or possibly even Washington, D.C. But the years before 1914 had been marked by rising tensions in the Near East, in the former Ottoman sphere. There had been two wars in the Balkans, the so-called Balkan Wars. The year before that, there had been a war with Italy. So to some extent, you could see almost a coherent picture of rising tensions in one corner of Europe, abutting the Middle East. But that's not to say necessarily, again, that today, I mean, the thing is people keep mixing their metaphors. Mm-hmm. People are saying, oh, well, look, you have the South China Sea and the Senkaku Islands dispute. You have a rising power in China. Maybe China's like Germany in 1914. But a lot of those analogies are actually, I think, resting on false assumptions. I mean, to take the one about China and Germany, I actually think there's a better analogy to make that China today bears a lot more resemblance to Russia in 1914. That is to say, a continental-sized colossus with these somewhat awe-inspiring economic growth statistics with the raw power indices and so on. When people were talking about Germany in 1914, well, sure, there was a certain sense that the rise of Germany had destabilized Europe. But in fact, more people in the years before that were actually talking about this staggering growth in Russian power. So the thing that people are talking about one day isn't necessarily what will either lead to the conflict or what they'll be talking about later. Malaysian Airlines flight, to give an example, people talk about the idea of a black swan or an unexpected event like the Sarajevo incident. I don't think anyone was expecting even 2 weeks ago that, of course, this airliner would be shot down over Ukrainian airspace. This would cause a major international crisis. I think history has a way of surprising us, and I think history surprised everyone in 1914, and unfortunately, we had better, I think, be ready for more surprises.
Margaret, one of your books is The Uses and Abuses of History. What can we usefully look back on World War I for now in terms of guidance or cautionary lessons as we look at a new time when new powers are rising, major powers are rising, old orders seem somehow inadequate?
I think we have to be careful not to look for very tight lessons. Mm-hmm. Because every historical time is different, every combination of circumstances is different. And, of course, one of the things that's different today is that we know what happened then, and so that is somehow somewhere in our thinking. I think where history can help is simply to offer warnings. If you aren't careful, you can find yourself very rapidly in a situation which gets out of control, which is what happened, I think, in the summer of 1914. It took them 5 weeks to go from really that long period of peace in Europe, which Jack mentioned.
90 years.
Over 90 years, mm-hmm. to all-out war. I mean, it's a very, very short time. I think we have to be aware also of the role of accident. The First World War needn't have happened, I think. Accident plays a very large part in it. So what do we learn? We learn that, I think, care is necessary, trying to communicate with the other side is necessary, having international institutions is necessary. But if we think we can sit here in 2014 and say, okay, now let's unroll the blueprint from 1914, or let's unroll the blueprint from 1814, and we will know exactly what to do now in 2014, it's not going to happen that way.
Do you have a sense today of an old order, what we thought of as the 20th century order, or what emerged by the end of the 20th century, as being up against it, up against tensions which could break it, are breaking it?
Well, we've always had tensions in the international order. I mean, I think we should be careful about overstating this time as one of great tensions. If you think of the Cold War, I mean, think of 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis, or 1983 when KL-07 was shot down, or earlier on when the Berlin Wall went up. I mean, I think the international order perhaps by its very nature, tends to produce crises because you have different national interests competing. You have transnational movements of religious ideologies or political ideologies which will disturb the scene. And so I think there's always change taking place in the international order. Perhaps what makes ours more complicated today is it truly is a global order. I mean, it used to be that you had regional tensions, but now every part of the world is linked to other parts of the world. So something that happens quite far away, say from North America, will have repercussions on our way of life here, and vice versa. And so I think we're living in a time of change, but it's very hard to look back at history and see times that would have changed. I mean, even that long 19th century in Europe, there were times of real crisis. When Germany became a country, for example, there was real fear of an international war. And so I think, you know, we need to avoid excessive pessimism about our own times.
Amen. Nobody's looking for world war, and yet we don't want to avoid lessons either. JFK looked back in the Cuban Missile Crisis on that war. Sung behind us, of course, rallied American troops. Do you know the story of how this war began? Do you see parallels today? Are you worried? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about war and peace and sliding into war on the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, how the world slid into catastrophe and our, maybe, risks today. The war began in 1914. July 28th, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, and then boom, 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 declarations of war all around. The United States neutral at first, but that would not last. By 1915, here was Horatio Bottomley, a member of the British Parliament, just the next year, talking about the nature of World War I, its catastrophic nature.
The more I ponder over this ghastly thing, the more convinced do I become that we are witnessing something greater than any war which has ever yet been waged in the history of mankind.
This ghastly thing, and it was ghastly very quickly. American troops got involved. Here was General John Joseph Black Jack Pershing, the commander-in-chief of the American Expeditionary Force in Europe, speaking from the Allied headquarters in Chaumont, France, probably April 1918.
3,000 miles from home, an American army is fighting for you. Everything you hold worthwhile is at stake. Only the hardest blows can win against the enemy we are fighting. Invoking the spirit of our forefathers, the Army asks your unflinching support to the end that the high ideals for which America stands may endure upon the earth.
Margaret McMillan is with us, author of The War That Ended Peace, renowned historian of this period and more, joins us from Toronto today. Sean McMeekin is here, author of July 1914, Countdown to War and the Russian Origins of the First World War, professor at Koç University in Istanbul, Turkey, joins us from Istanbul. And our own Jack Beatty is here, author of The Lost History of 1914, Reconsidering the Year the Great War Began. Margaret McMillan, remind us of how deadly the war became, just how quickly it became that deadly.
Well, it was partly the very success of Europe in developing this extraordinary industry, science, and technology. They were very good at killing each other. The weapons were more deadly than they had been even 10 years before. They had huge mass armies. They were capable of putting huge armies into the field and keeping them there. And the casualties were huge. I mean, some of the very worst casualties, in fact, were in the first months of the war in 1914. Very, very heavy casualties taken by the British, who lost almost the equivalent of in numbers of the whole force they'd sent over to France in August 1914. Very heavy casualties for the French, the Russians, the Germans, the Serbians. And I think what was so appalling to Europeans was that the war then developed into a stalemate, which seemed to have no end. And they had the capacity to put these, European countries had the capacity to put these huge armies into the fields, but the opposing sides were so evenly balanced that neither side had the capacity to win an overwhelming victory over the other. They hadn't expected this, and I suspect that the decisions of those who took Europe to war in the summer of 1914 might have been different if they could have foreseen just what the war was going to turn into.
I mean, we're looking here already by September 6th, the First Battle of Marne. Checking the German advance cost, as you say, 13,000 British lives, 250,000 French casualties, another 250,000 German casualties. These are mind-boggling numbers, Margaret.
Yeah, they're absolutely huge. And, of course, it was going to go on. I mean, we'll never know how many casualties, how many dead and how many wounded there were in the First World War because the records, of course, are incomplete. But I think historians would agree that at least 9 million men died, which is a huge figure. I mean, it unthinkable, I think, to most of us today, and probably twice as many more wounded. And, of course, at the end of the war, just as the war was ending, that deadly influenza epidemic hit the world, and it tended, we think, now to be carried by the movements of troops around the world. So it really was a worldwide contagion, catastrophe.
Sean McMeekin, help us here with what was called then the July crisis. June 28th, we had the assassination of the Archduke, the Austrian Archduke in Sarajevo, of course, famously, by a 19-year-old Bosnian Serb. A month later, July 28th, we have this declaration of war. 30 days to drive the world to war seems unbelievably fast. Give us the short course on what happened in that July crisis, Sean.
Well, the pickle that the Austrians were in, on the one hand, there was something we might call almost a war party in Austria. And the most vociferous member of this was the chief of army staff, Konrad von Hutzendorf, who had, according to legend, had advocated going to war with Serbia something like 25 times in the previous year alone. Serbia, having fought in both of the Balkan Wars, nearly doubled in size. Serbia was kind of the big kid on the block, bursting through its britches, threatening Austria at every turn. So it was no secret that there was a war party in Vienna. The difference was, first of all, that Franz Ferdinand himself had been firmly opposed to the war party. And so removing him from the equation was rather important. The other important part of the equation of the personalities was that Kaiser Wilhelm II, the German sovereign, who by reputation was rather bellicose, he was actually somewhat misleading. He was kind of a classic case of loud bark and little bite. Mm-hmm. He tended to back down in most international crises. In fact, you know, he was really distrusted by the generals as being unreliable in the crunch. What was interesting, he was quite close to Franz Ferdinand. So what the Austrians actually tried to do was to pin him down while he was still enraged by the murder of his friend. And they very nearly failed to do so because they didn't actually finally confront him until about a week afterwards when the ambassador met him and they had a special mission to Berlin. They did get the Kaiser partly because he was just manipulated and badgered into it. Against his better inclinations, he did give Austria this backing we usually refer to as the blank check. But even then, the Austrians took several weeks to get their act together. A number of reasons for this. They had to convince the Hungarian minister president. They called it the dual monarchy because Hungary literally had almost a veto power over actions by Vienna. There was also an issue with the army. The army actually went on harvest leave in July. And so the army was not able to take the decisive step that both the Austrian military command wanted, but also the Germans wanted. They didn't want a world war. What they wanted was for the Austrians to move decisively. Instead, they dithered and delayed, and by the time they finally got their act together, the whole thing had really gone wrong for both the Germans and the Austrians. What's interesting about it was right before this date that you settled in on, that is the date we're now on the 100th anniversary of July 28th, the Austrians had just told the Germans they would not actually be ready to invade Serbia until August 12th. And so the last the Germans had heard, Austria-Hungary was actually going to wait until mid-August to finally move against Serbia, which would have been literally 6 or 7 weeks after the Sarajevo incident. To the surprise of a lot of people, Austria-Hungary instead declared war by telegram in French. And this is on the date of July 28th, round about noon. It was such a curious and unprecedented act. In fact, literally, it had never been done before, the declaration of war by telegram. The Serbian Prime Minister, Nikolai Pašić, actually wired to Paris, St. Petersburg, and London asking for clarification of this strange, incomprehensible message he had received. It turned out that the Austro-Hungarian military had not wanted the declaration of war. Very much getting your carrots and your sticks backwards and doing diplomacy the wrong way round. Apparently, it was the sole decision of the foreign minister, Leopold von Berchtold. And I have tried, I've racked my head trying to figure out why he did this. And what I finally came up with, my own explanation, is that he was getting so many peace and treaties from across Europe that he basically just didn't want to answer them anymore. In essence, he didn't want to have to answer his phone. And so he declared war on Serbia, despite the fact that Austria-Hungary would not be ready for another 2 weeks actually to fight Serbia. Now, what's curious about this is the Germans were actually starting to get cold feet. The Kaiser, this very morning, before he knew about this, and he had no idea that Austria-Hungary was about to declare war on Serbia, he actually sent a message to Vienna saying they should begin negotiating with the Serbs. The very next day, the chancellor more or less rescinded this so-called blank check to Austria, saying, look, we're isolated. We don't want to be dragged wantonly and without regard to our advice into a world conflagration. However, precisely in order to cut off peace and treaties, the Austro-Hungarian foreign minister had leaned on the military to kind of carry out a symbolic shelling of Belgrade. This is on the 29th, which was the literal act of war. That is to say that they went over the edge. And even though it was mostly symbolic and did very little damage, it was rather hard to go back once they declared war and then actually started shelling Serbia. And so the Germans really were trapped by this, by their allies' dithering delays and utter incompetence into backing them right to the hilt and then in the end going over the edge into the abyss with them.
Jack, the popular perception has come to be that this was the result of a whole lot of secret alliances, and once the dominoes started to tip, nobody could say no. Nobody could back out. There was an inexorable quality to this. Has that held up, Jack, that view?
I think it has. Political scientists call it chain ganging, that one partner is reckless and pulls the other partner along. Looking around the world today for echoes of that, you might see it in the U.S. relationship with Japan, a newly nationalist Japan confronting China over its islands, the islands in the South China Sea, is the U.S. sufficiently restraining its ally? Russia did not, far from restraining Serbia. Russia encouraged Serbia. And so the alliance was sprung that way by essentially encouraging the weak member of it. Interestingly, off stage, the role of the French, I think, deserves a word. I mean, often they're depicted as the innocent victims of German aggression. But, as Sean points out, as Margaret pointed out, the French president, Raymond Poincaré, extended the security commitment to Russia, secret treaty back from the 1890s. He basically extended that to the border between Serbia and Austria-Hungary with no public debate, with no knowledge, the assembly had no say in it at all. It was just on his own bat. And that, of course, emboldened both parties, both Serbia and Russia, to say, my gosh, we're going to stand up to these Austrians, because now we've got the French essentially agreeing to this, to draw the line of the alliance here. And, of course, it didn't have any deterrent value because the Austrians didn't know about it.
And, of course, before you knew it, though it was years still, America was in. Tensions raised in the United States because so many Americans had family origins and went back to many different countries. Here was the former U.S. ambassador to Germany, James Gerard Watson, in New York on November 25th, 1917, talking about the German peril. America had entered the war earlier that year in April.
Everyone had a right to sympathize with any warring nation. But now that we are in the war, there are only two sides, and the time has come when every citizen must declare himself American or traitor.
Declare yourself, my fellow Americans, and then the call on all Americans to sacrifice here. This was Frank Vanderlip, president of National City Bank, urging Americans to be part of the 100 million army, in other words, everybody, and make sacrifices at home. Don't try and live in luxury while others are fighting.
You must go or forego. You must fight or sacrifice. You are the Kaiser's ally. If you make men work for you manufacturing luxuries while guns are still unforged and ships unbuilt, join the 100 million army.
You must go or forego. Tina in Evansville, Indiana. Thank you for calling, Tina. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hello.
I'm hello.
Yes, you're on.
I'm reading The Proud Tower, and I'm only about four chapters into it, by Barbara Tuchman. Mm-hmm. And as I understand her thesis so far, the problems leading up 20 to 30 years before World War I had to do with the disparity between the haves and the have-nots, those wealthy living very lavishly irresponsible lives. I would like to see someone address that, if possible.
Margaret, can you speak to that?
There were tensions inside European societies. The pace of change had been very quick, and not everyone had benefited from the tremendous increase in prosperity. And so, yes, there were tensions. You could see it in the growth of the labor movement, the growth of socialist parties, increasingly militant strikes in some cases. But on the other hand, those were being dealt with in some countries. The Germans had brought in a whole comprehensive system of social benefits, unemployment insurance, for example, old age pensions, and the British were moving in the same direction. And they were increasing, a number of countries were increasing taxation on the very rich. In the United States, of course, you had the progressive movement, which was, at least in part, directed against monopoly power and the power of Wall Street and the power of the great fortunes. And so I think, you know, that there were indeed tensions in Europe, but those were in some cases being dealt with quite successfully and quite peacefully. And so I think those who'd argue that in some ways the tensions within European societies helped to contribute to the war, the picture, in my view, is much more mixed and much more nuanced, and you can really argue it either way.
Sean McMeekin, there was still imperial appetite here. You look at Russia, and Russia, looking at the Ottoman Empire, very much in the news in our time, that arena of the world, that area, and wanting a piece of what they saw as coming undone.
Well, that's right. The Ottoman Empire for Russia, I put it different ways in my various books, but if you're talking about just your neighborhood, that is your geopolitical neighborhood, it would be the equivalent of something like the border crisis people are talking about right now with the United States and Mexico. That is, it's Russia's literally, it's on her southern border. A lot of her vital interests were tied up with the Ottoman Empire, with the Black Sea, with the so-called straits, that is, the waterways connecting the Black Sea to the Mediterranean, which essentially constituted Russia's only warm water access to world markets at a time when Russia was rapidly industrializing, with a need both for massive exports of wheat to raise hard currency to pay for the import of particularly high-end components for a lot of the industries, many of which were in South Russia and Ukraine. Now, in the 3 years before 1914, there had been three very serious crises. In fact, actual wars. The first between Turkey, or the Ottoman Empire, it was then called, and Italy, a war which actually broke out in Tripoli. You're talking about places in the headlines. The most serious fighting in that war actually happened in the suburbs of Benghazi, where some of the future young Turk triumvirs and Mustafa Kemal Ataturk himself first saw serious action. It was actually during that war that the Ottoman Empire closed the Dardanelles. That is, they literally stretched steel chains across the water, thus forbidding access for all ships, both commercial vessels and warships, to the straits. And this was terrifying to the Russians. It was a little bit like someone had just locked her southern exit. Someone had closed her own door.
Closed the door. Sean McMeekin, hold the thought. We've got to take a short break right here. Of course, Russia, Vladimir Putin, and more back in the headlines today. Ukraine and all the rest. We're looking at World War I, how it began, and what we might learn from it in our time of tension. This A World Requiem, John Folds, written between 1919 and 1921 as a memorial to those millions of dead in the wake of World War I. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about war and peace and sliding into war on the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, how the world slid into that catastrophe, and maybe looking at our risks Today, Margaret MacMillan is with us, celebrated historian, author most lately of The War That Ended Peace, all about World War I. Sean McMeekin is with us, author of The Russian Origins of the First World War. You'd begun to hear him pin back to Moscow and Russia. Jack Beattie's with us, who's written also History of World War I, The Lost History of 1914, Reconsidering the Year the Great War Began. Let me go to Gordon, calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Gordon, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. First, I wanted to say that one of my most valuable pieces of family heirlooms is a cigarette case that my mother's uncle received from Princess Mary at Christmas in 1914. I never sell it. But my real comment that I wanted to make is how interesting it is that oil had just been recently discovered in these in the Middle East then, and that the boundaries after the war were clearly drawn up as a way of exploiting that to the maximum, and we're still inheriting these problems today as the Middle East has not settled down at all. That's basically all I wanted to say.
Yeah, many borders drawn, redrawn. Margaret MacMillan, you look deeper into the history of World War I, and before you know it, there are British troops in Baghdad and along the Euphrates. Remind us of how World War I came to engulf the Middle East and regions so much in the news today, Margaret.
Well, the war was between not just European countries, it was between European countries and their empires. And it drew in men from all around the world. I mean, Canadians fought in Europe, Australians fought in Europe and in the Middle East, New Zealanders fought, Indians fought, something like a million Indian troops were fighting both on the European soil and in the Middle East. And so it was always a world war. And part of what happened as a result of the war was a disposition of the territory that had belonged to the defeated nations. And in any case, I think new boundaries would have had to be drawn because the Ottoman Empire was on its way out and something had to be done to deal with the map of the Middle East as the Ottoman Empire was disappearing. Now, I think a lot of what was done was questionable, but I don't think it was entirely about oil. I think there also was an attempt, for example, to create a Palestine, which would, from the British point of view, safeguard the entrance to the Suez Canal. There was an attempt to put together what had been three provinces of the Ottoman Empire, which had always had some relationship with each other, and that became Iraq. And so other considerations came into account. But I think when you look at the peace settlements that were made in the Middle East, they were made very much to suit the European powers, in particular Britain and France. And I think that has caused resentment in the Middle East ever since. And it's one of the reasons that there is such resentment in many parts of the Middle East towards what's seen as the West. And the United States, although it wasn't involved much in drawing those boundaries, in a way has inherited some of that resentment, which used to be felt towards the big European powers.
Jack, if you want a sense of the resonance of this war, its long echo, I mean, just look at how these, in many cases, are still the boundaries that are so much in dispute right now that we're still living with tension over.
I saw a reference in the paper the other day to the Sykes-Picot Agreement that right now ISIS, this terrorist jihadi group out of Syria and Iraq, is tearing up the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which is the treaty, the agreement essentially between the British and the French that carved up the carcass of the Turk, as Prime Minister Asquith put it. Yes, I mean, very much in the news today, and you know, elsewhere the war continues to. I mean, you know, some of the instabilities in Africa and the, you know, the wars of national unity and so on there, brought on by the European boundaries put down in Africa either before or after the war. So yes, we're living with the statesmen at Versailles. You know, I think they labored in good faith in some cases, in many cases, but what they produced had all sorts of ramifications around the world and, of course, in Europe. And the irony is that the Americans, you know, Woodrow Wilson was the most opposed to these imperial deals. This was why, you know, he had got into the war. We don't want any part. We were an associated power. We weren't an ally because that would taint us with British imperialism. And yet he signed on to a document that extended imperialism around the globe.
Sean McMeekin, here we are in 2014 and we're back in the Black Sea again. You write about how Russians cared so about that southern exit or entrance to their waters, to their ports. Now we've got Moscow, you know, back in Sebastopol. We've got all this tension on the borders of Ukraine. What about the tensions there? Russia and this particular facet of its geography now and then?
Well, it sort of disappeared from the story. I mean, we were just hearing about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, as we often do. You don't often hear about Sazonov, who was the Russian signatory to the agreement, and in fact, was primarily a Russian project. When Lloyd George came up with this phrase about the carcass of the Turk, that is referring to this project of dismembering the Ottoman Empire, it was actually in March 1915. The British were hammering away at the Dardanelles, and Russia was blackmailing Britain and France, who were trying to open up the straits for her, with very little Russian help, mind you. Russia was blackmailing them into signing off, that is, in the post-war world, to Russia's claim on Constantinople, that is, Istanbul, and the Ottoman Straits, including a lot of the territory both to the east and the west of the Straits, much of the littoral of the Sea of Marmara, places in Thrace, or Trakya, as the Turks call it today, places in Anatolia, then called Asia Minor. The Russians, in fact, got a huge quadrant of modern Turkey, basically everything from the Caucasus down to about the middle of the country, and you know, they're bandying about whether or not they want to have naval communications from Sevastopol to Sinop, which is a port in the north part of Turkey, which the Americans actually used as a listening post in the Cold War. It was actually a Russian project to which Britain and France signed on, and as they put it somewhat cynically, we might as well submit our own desiderata, that is, our own claims to the carcass. So it's not really an accident, that is, that this all happened, nor is it an accident, of course, that we still have tensions in a place like Ukraine. Ukraine was, in fact, one of the most bitterly contested battlefields of the First World War, although it was, of course, more at the end of the war, that is, in the chaos of the Russian Revolution. Another forgotten aspect of the story is that the Germans basically conquered and they occupied Ukraine. Part of the reason that the Germans later gave so many Germans listen to Hitler's message, this idea that they were stabbed in the back somehow, they hadn't really lost the war, is that in the East they actually had won the war. They had conquered Russia. They were carving up Russia. They had carved up the Ukraine. They had carved up much of the North Caucasus. They were contesting Baku, which is actually a much larger oil-producing center at the time than Iraq or Mesopotamia was. So there was this entire strange world aborning. And in fact, to some extent, America's entry into the war, I think, upset the apple cart. That is to say, it radically changed the outcome of the war. And the Americans ended up being in a really peculiar position, not least because they had not declared war on the Ottoman Empire. And yet all factions in the Ottoman Empire were now looking at the Americans as the most neutral broker. They were hoping the Americans could come in and save them from the British or the French, or replace the Russians in a much more constructive role. And yet, of course, the Americans didn't have much appetite for that. Woodrow Wilson didn't really have any appetite for an imperial commitment to Turkey, although it's forgotten the Americans were actually offered the mandate. That is, these mandates everyone talks about, the Middle East given to Britain and France, were actually offered to the Americans. The Americans actually got the much juicier mandates. The Americans were supposed to control Constantinople, that is, Istanbul and the Straits, and the bulk of Asia Minor, as we call today Anatolia, essentially modern Turkey, was supposed to be an American colony. It's interesting, of course, that the Americans declined the offer, and whether or not that's for the best for Americans and for Turks today, I think probably most would agree that it is. There's another interesting what if.
Mm-hmm. Margaret McMillan, you mentioned early on how World War I propelled us into a century of extreme right and left. Mark that out for us just for a minute here, how it propelled the Bolsheviks and communism in Russia, how it propelled Hitler and fascism in Germany.
Many of these ideas were floating around before the war, but I think the First World War really creates the circumstances in which they can flourish. I think if you look at the Bolsheviks before the First World War, they were a tiny splinter group. The other left-wing groups in Russia were much more powerful, had much more popular support. But it's really the First World War that gives the Bolsheviks their opportunity, and they seize power in a coup d'etat in 1917. And that, of course, becomes hugely influential, not only because Russia becomes, of course, as the Soviet Union, a leading exponent of Bolshevik communism, but it begins to spread around the world. And I think without the First World War, we probably would not have seen that sort of spread of that particular variation of communism. And I think ideas on the right, again, fascist ideas, racial ideas, ideas about order and authority and mobilizing societies if it was an army, or ultra-nationalism, those again had been around before the First World War. But the First World War, by upsetting so much of European society and by destroying so much of the old order, creates the environment in which such ideas can flourish. And I think Hitler was able to make great play both with what was felt to be an unfair treaty imposed on Germany, a denial that Germany had actually been defeated on the battlefield. And Hitler was able to use that to mobilize opinion in what was a very unhappy and confused Germany in the 1920s. And I think it's striking how many former soldiers supported both the highly organized movements of the left and the right. I think they found in them often the sort of authority and camaraderie that they'd found actually in the trenches or on the battlefields of the First World War. And so I think the First World War doesn't create these ideologies, but it helps them to flourish. It creates the circumstances in which they can grow.
And for the rest of the century, so much wrestling with them. David in New York City. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. I think one of the sort of much larger lessons from the First World War for our time really concerns the utility of war as an instrument of policy. The First World War was the first among the great powers that ended with all combatants recognizing that the horrors and the costs simply didn't justify any of the gains, and that they never wanted to do it again. This was a huge departure from prior European wars, which had generally had at least one winning party and a pretty a recent record of decisive outcomes, the wars of unification in the in Italy and Germany, for example. But, you know, it took another half century for the lesson about the horrors of war really to take hold. I mean, via the Second World War, ultimately for us in Vietnam. But it bought us half a century of essentially peace among the great powers. And today, America, since September 11th, 2001, seems to have unlearned that lesson, and everybody is paying a price.
Reopening that Pandora's box of
war is an instrument of policy.
Yeah. David, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, you're quite lined up with David's view here. I mean, before World War One, there was a view popular in maybe elite circles, maybe more in Europe, that war was sort of, was a healthy tonic once in a while. World War One really battered that. World War Two, our caller says, put paid to it with the horror of the atomic bomb, but he worries that now we've sort of lost that sense of its lack of utility as an instrument of policy.
Yes, a German paper wrote in 1913, war is beautiful. Its greatness lifts a man's heart high above earthly things. There was this celebration of war, as you say, as a tonic, as a sort of school for character. It was utterly out of line with the realities of war and the languages of the language, of course, used at the time. Someone's chest was one's breast. You know, the enemy was the foe. There was all this diction, this high diction, that really made war seem like something out of the Crusades. You know, knights colliding, but you know. Gordon makes an excellent point, and America was shielded from the horrors of the Second War. It didn't happen here. It happened there. There's a very good book by Jim Sheehan in Stanford saying, you know, where have all the soldiers gone? Talking about Europe after the Second World War, and really that did change all, or seemingly all, European opinion about war. But you know, there's something else too, and that is that maybe battle, that is the, you know, two nations confronting each other, a la the Battle of the Marne, 970,000 French and British attacking 750,000 Germans over a 100-mile front in the climactic act of that war, that's not possible today. John Keegan, in his classic The Face of Battle, wonders aloud, is battle abolishing itself? That is, have we reached a point where you simply can't concentrate forces like that without drones and missiles and God knows what else raining down on them, such that the French and the Germans in 1914 would have been decimated even before they got to the line, and that in some weird way, technology, which has seemed like the enemy all along, as Margaret said, it got so far ahead of moral control, but technology here in making the battlefield an unlivable environment might actually be on the side of peace.
Margaret, we just have a minute. You've written recently that it may be that looking back to World War One, you wrote, can still help us toward a more peaceful future. What would you whisper in the ear of leaders today that they take from this war's legacy as we look at our current kind of disorderly circumstances?
I think what I would advise leaders, but they wouldn't listen to me anyway, but what I'd advise them is not to get themselves into positions that they can't back down from. I think what happened in the outbreak of the First World War was that different powers staked out positions which involved their honor, their prestige, their credibility, whatever you want to call it, and then they found it very difficult to back down. And I think it's a mistake not to leave a way out and not to be willing to negotiate. That doesn't mean you have to be weak, but I think not to put yourself in a position where you don't have any way out but to keep going forward towards war, I think is very important.
Today, we will listen to that and take it with gratitude. Margaret McMillan at Oxford, joining us today from Toronto, author of The War That Ended Peace. Margaret, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Sean McMeekin, history professor at Koç University in Istanbul, author of The Russian Origins of the First World War. Sean, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
And Jack Beatty, author of The Lost History of 1914 and On Point news analyst. Jack, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We go out with, and the band played Waltzing Matilda, written by Eric Bogle. The song tells the story of a young Australian soldier injured in World War I's Gallipoli battle. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And so now, every April, I sit on me porch and I watch the parade pass before me. And I see my old comrades, how proudly they march, reviving old dreams of past glories. And the old men march slowly, all bones stiff and sore. They're tired old heroes from a forgotten war. And the young people ask, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question.